Full Story is supported by Telstra. Big ambitions need the right partner, and that's where Telstra comes in. Telstra works with enterprise and government organisations across Australia to help them build, connect, and grow at scale. They support real outcomes, from secure business growth to connecting schools to networks that help keep communities safe. Telstra is a long-term partner for organisations with complex needs and big plans. Together builds better, wherever they go. For enterprise-sized solutions, partner with Telstra.
Gillian Ambrose, you're the Guardian's energy correspondent, and you've been keeping a very close eye on the impact that the war on Iran is having on global oil and gas prices. Let's begin with why the Strait of Hormuz, a stretch of water between the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Oman. Can you tell me a bit more about the geography of it and, you know, which countries border it and why it's so crucial to understanding this story?
Absolutely. This really is a story about geography. And if you think about the Strait of Hormuz and the Persian Gulf, it's useful to think of a literal geographical bottleneck. It's not a two-way system. It's enclosed, and you've got this really small, narrow neck where 20% of global oil trade flows through from this very oil-rich region into the global market. As well as 20% of global seaborne oil trade, there's also the world's largest exporter of gas, which is Qatar. They are also within the Gulf. And this flow of vessels that needs to go through really doesn't have any other options. There's one or two pipelines which can connect to the Red Sea or bypass the Strait of Hormuz. But other than those very few pipelines, the only way is through the strait.
Right.
And Iran knows that, and the market knows that. And the narrowest part is right below Iran. Mm. And that is something which the regime has always threatened to exploit. It's something that even days before the attacks began, I think analysts were still seeing as a worst case scenario, that the kind of last resort tactic of a desperate regime. And it happened far sooner than we thought.
So as you said, it is an essential passage for some of the world's largest oil producers and exporters, and crucially with Iran overlooking its narrowest point and using it as a frontier in this war. So where the US and Israel have used airstrikes and bombarded the country, Iran is fighting back with the strait. Gillian, can you tell me about what it's actually looked like out there and the impact that that's then had on the global supply and price of energy?
Absolutely. We're now entering the third week of this conflict. It began on Saturday morning with airstrikes from the US and Israel on Iran. What we didn't realize, perhaps, was that Iran would effectively close the strait.
Iran's Revolutionary Guard is sending radio transmissions to ships, warning them that, quote, no ship is allowed to pass the Strait of Hormuz. That's according to the EU.
They've not formally, officially shut it down, but they have said that they will set ablaze any tanker that tries to move through. For any shipping owner, for any insurer, that is as good as closed.
Donald Trump has threatened Iran with death, fire and fury if it jeopardizes the transport of oil through the Strait of Hormuz, which is the main...
We've seen the number of vessels moving through the strait absolutely dwindle, and these vessels are now effectively stuck. I think there's around 200 tankers still stuck in the Strait of Hormuz.
Right.
I think in the first week of the crisis, we actually saw quite a muted response from the market. It was almost like everyone was holding their breath, waiting to see what would happen. Would this be a short-lived thing, and would a trade through the Strait of Hormuz be able to resume as normal?
It's doing well. The market's holding up well. I figured we'd be hit a little bit, but we were hit probably less than I thought, and we'll be back on track in a pretty short while.
But what we've seen since is that this could be a far more drawn-out conflict than they had originally assumed.
As missiles fly over the Middle East, crude prices are busting at the seams. 2 hours
oil ago, prices have risen, at one point hitting $100 a barrel again.
They're briefly surging towards $120 a barrel.
Prices are coming down very substantially. Oil will be coming down. That's just a matter of war.
we saw prices in the second week absolutely rocket up into, I think it was $116 a barrel at one point. Mm. And this has been allayed in some senses because the International Energy Agency, the sort of unofficial energy watchdog of the world, has called on governments to release emergency stocks of crude into the market to help cool the market a little bit. As soon as that was on the table, I think we did start to see prices moving down again.
CNN is learning Iran has begun laying mines in the Strait of Hormuz. It's another major complication as the world's top oil...
But everyone has been very clear that unless ships are moving through the Strait of Hormuz, oil prices will continue to rise.
Gillian, over the weekend, the US attacked Iran's Karg Island. It now says that it may attack again, to quote, just for fun. I don't know if you saw over the weekend, but, you know, as long ago as 1988, Trump, in an interview with Polly Toynbee, had his eye on Karg Island. He said, I'd do a number on Karg Island. I'd go in and I'd take it. And it's just astonishing given that where we are now. But what can you tell me about the island itself and why it is so significant?
Yeah, the island is absolutely the heartbeat of the Iranian economy. This is where 90% of its oil is exported from. It's effectively an island which it hosts a giant processing facility and export hub. So this is where tankers will arrive. They'll load up with Iranian crude and they will then transit through the Strait of Hormuz. By taking that, you're taking the petrostate's economic lifeblood. It is a major blow to the Iranian regime. At the moment, there has been no damage done to the oil infrastructure there. And I think that is really important because if it did, that would be crippling to Iran, not just now, but potentially for years and years into the future. But it would also compound the crisis that we're seeing in the global oil market too. And that is something that I think Trump would definitely want to avoid. So he's talking quite tough, but I think it would be a case of cutting your nose despite your face if you did damage that oil infrastructure on Karg Island.
President Trump today reiterating his calls for allies to help protect global oil shipments through the Strait of Hormuz, saying that protecting the waterway is supposed to be a team effort.
Well, on Sunday, he did also then urge a number of countries, including the UK, to deploy warships to the Strait, which sort of goes some way to indicate how crippling the Iranian stronghold of the Strait could be for the global economy, or is, rather. Gillian, how did the UK and its allies respond?
I would say it's been tepid, the response. I think this plan to have military escorts help these tankers to cross through the Strait into the global market is something that could help a little bit, but it certainly wouldn't resolve the crisis. I don't think you'd be able to move tankers through at nearly the pace that the market needs. Japan and Australia have said that they are not sending military assistance at this stage. The UK is, I believe, offering minesweeping to help in that regard. But what I cynically noted on Sunday with a lot of this talk about military escorts is that Trump makes these comments right before the markets open and start trading again in the new week in Australia. And a lot of these comments, I think, perhaps might be designed to calm the markets before trading starts again. We didn't see that. We saw a 3% rise instantly as soon as markets opened. Oil jumped back up to $106 a barrel, and it just shows that this is not the solution that the market is looking for. The market is looking for business as usual. They want tankers moving through the Strait of Hormuz. They want barrels of crude getting into the global market. An escort might help a little bit. Pipelines rerouting might help a little bit. But the market doesn't need a little bit of help. It needs a solution.
So, Gillian, is it fair to say that we are currently facing a new oil crisis? And if so, just how bad could it get?
I would say not only is this a new oil crisis, but it is the greatest oil supply shock in the history of the market.
Wow.
That was the message from the International Energy Agency last week, that its member states would need to release more emergency crude stocks into the market to temper prices than has ever been seen before.
Wow.
And they only do these releases every so often. It's really to address major crisis situations. And it is by far the largest release of crude, more than double what was released in the 2022 crisis after Russia invaded Ukraine. I've seen some banking analysts, notably Goldman Sachs, which is a major player in the oil market, saying that the impact of shutting the Strait of Hormuz will be 17 times the impact of Russia stopping its exports.
Wow.
So it is massive. It's hard to quantify. It's hard to wrap your head around. But this is a major crisis for the oil market, and it leaves nothing untouched.
Gillian, could you explain how that, this crisis in the oil market, then does just trickle down and affect everyone? Because, you know, what does the oil in the Strait ultimately become, and why is it having the impact it has?
Oh, absolutely. The energy costs, in so many ways, are the ultimate economic contagion. It just gets into absolutely every part of the economy. If you think about your day-to-day life, the goods that you consume, the services that you use, they all rely on energy at some point. So when the cost goes up, everything that you consume or use will become more costly too. So it's an economy-wide problem. It is likely to stoke inflation, and this could even affect your mortgage, because interest rates might not be able to come down as fast as they might have. And it worries me quite a lot, because you think about families who are only just getting their heads above water. The UK at the moment has record high levels of household energy debt. That's been rising since the Ukraine crisis. What this means for people is quite far-reaching, and it's devastating for families. It can be devastating for small businesses. It's difficult to look anywhere in your daily life and not see an area that would be impacted by a surge in energy costs.
God, it's terrifying when you put it like that. I mean, I was thinking about the impact it has on, like, the global south. Like, it's absolutely huge, and it's kind of immediate. But of course, it trickles down to everyone, no matter where you are in the West.
Literally everyone. A lot of the emerging economies in Asia are, like, particularly exposed. What we're seeing in countries like Pakistan and Bangladesh is what they call demand destruction in the market. That's basically when you can't afford the energy, so you need to turn it off yourself. Even if you could access it, it's just too expensive. So we are seeing almost COVID-style lockdown initiatives. Schools are being closed, people being asked to work from home, all to conserve energy.
And it's also worth noting that those countries already have policies of load shedding in place, which they have for years, which means that there are certain times which certain districts have to turn all the gas off, or they don't have the lights on. Do you know, it's already exists. So to have this on top of that, it's just mind blowing.
Yeah. If you look at how reliant different countries are on Middle Eastern oil and gas, you can see that a lot of these countries are perhaps overly reliant. And that's why it's just hitting them so much harder. There is nowhere else to go. Europe has a more diverse range of suppliers. The UK actually relies on Gulf energy stocks for a very small proportion of our energy, but it still affects the global market. So we're still paying those prices.
So what have oil producing nations and importers been doing to counter all of this? And how is that going?
I think those in the Gulf have been trying their absolute best to keep their production running. We've seen storage tanks filling up and pipelines which can bypass the Strait of Hormuz being used at much higher capacities. Saudi Arabia, for example, has a 746-mile-long pipeline which stretches from its east coast all the way to the west, which meets the Red Sea.
Right.
So it has already doubled the amount of oil it sends through that pipeline. It expects to increase that even further and hopefully keep its exports at about 70% of its usual rate. Otherwise, it's going to shut down two major oil fields, which doesn't sound like a big deal because we can't get the oil anyway. Mm. But for the producers, it is, because it can take weeks or even months to set these fields up again to start producing. And that's what's keeping prices high at the moment. We know we're not going to get any oil through the Strait of Hormuz, but what we don't know is whether the same oil supplies will be around even if the war ended tomorrow.
And as you said, Trump has been trying to reassure allies and markets that everything is under control, often with these wildly contradictory statements.
Well, it's only good if you win, you know, you can only do it. And we've won. Let me say, we've won.
Are you ready to officially declare victory?
Yes. No, I don't want to do that. There's no reason to.
But throughout all the threat of continued airstrikes, Iran is clearly at a military disadvantage, but its ability to choke the strait is an incredibly powerful one. Gillian, do you think it's possible that it could, in fact, end the war?
I struggle, to be honest, and I don't say this lightly. I struggle to see how this conflict can resolve. I see Donald Trump as a leader who wouldn't want to back down, who wouldn't want to admit defeat. And I see Iran as holding a lot of the cards in this conflict. I was looking at some data earlier today, which showed that Iranian exports of crude through the Strait of Hormuz are actually slightly higher today than they were before the crisis.
Right.
So they're okay. They're making money. They're shipping. Their crude is sanctioned, but it is still being bought by Chinese buyers.
Right.
And that trade is still happening. So when the Iranians make comments like, get ready for $200 barrel oil, I think the market's listening to that. They're hearing that when they say, we're not actually having talks with the White House about, you know, sort of negotiating an end to this. Why would we? And Trump is saying a lot of reassuring things, but it just doesn't seem to scan on the ground. I just can't see what he's seeing. I can't see how this plays out.
Gillian, as of recording, oil prices are still hovering above $100 a barrel. And at the start of this year, we were beginning to imagine a move away from the energy spikes caused by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And of course, now here we are. And I guess what I want to know is, what powers does the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, or the Energy Secretary, Ed Miliband, have against price rises and inflation? And, you know, should we be tapping into North Sea more, as has been suggested?
Yeah, I think an energy crisis always seems to fuel a debate about how the UK handles its own energy. In the Russia-Ukraine crisis, we saw a lot of people talking about doubling down on North Sea. Even fracking is back in the energy discourse when we start talking about security of supply. At the same time, if you are someone who leans more green, then this is a clear sign that we should be doing more green energy, become more self-sufficient in homegrown renewables, for example. So these energy crisis points tend to polarize the existing debate around how we handle energy.
There is one lesson from this crisis, Laura, and only one in my view for the long term on energy policy, and that is we need homegrown, clean power that we control.
My view, really, is that we do need to look at both sides. We do need to move to greener energy, of course, and then be more self-sufficient. There are so many good economic and environmental reasons for doing that. But I think we also do need to think about fossil fuels while we're still using them. Do we have enough gas storage, for example? Mm. Are there ways that we can be sort of better connected to European supplies? But all of these questions and theories are going to do very little to help us today. I think what the government right now is looking at is, if things get really bad, how can we help families? Mm. And that's important, because I think the government can't afford to step in every time there is a crisis to bail people out. The Treasury coffers just won't support that. So the government will have to make some really tough decisions in the weeks and months ahead.
Coming up, does the oil and gas crisis mean a quicker move to green energy?